Have you ever had a rival? And when I talk about a rival, I hesitate to use the word nemesis, but that is kind of what I'm going with. I don't know that we could ever have nemesis. I don't think any of us are in a position where we could really have a nemesis. But somebody who always seems to be at odds with you, could be at work, could be a family member, a person with whom you've had a long string of conflicts, just over it. Just seems like every time you interact with this person, it's negative, and they always get the thing that you want. Maybe it's a promotion at work. Maybe it's the last bite of food at Thanksgiving. Whatever it is, I don't know. Things that we have rivals, and maybe it's not even your fault, right? You've done everything that you can to be at peace with this person, and yet every time you have an interaction, it goes poorly. They always seem to be at odds with you. Maybe you don't have any ill will. That's fine, but you just, there's this person in your life that you just always seem to be in conflict with. Rivalries usually, almost always, no, I better hedge, almost always begin with one perceived slight and then they snowball. Somebody does something to somebody. So maybe somebody did something to you and you're the one that just wouldn't let it go. Or maybe it's the opposite, right? You did something to somebody else and they just wouldn't let it go. And the first initial thing wasn't that big of a deal. But then the next interaction you had, it also went poorly, and before you know it, it snowballs out of control, and you just can't ever get along with this person. I think we all probably have a rival in our lives. I don't know. There's a number of different people it could be in our lives, but it starts with one small thing and then just becomes this gigantic thing, and before you know it, you dislike that person so much and you don't even remember why. Seems like you've always disliked them, and you don't even remember the root cause. The rivalry between Edom and Israel was basically that on a national scale. One thing went wrong, and then before you know it, generations go by, and everybody hates each other, and they just always seem to be at odds. Genesis 25, 21 through 23, Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer. Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me? Why are these children fighting in my womb?" She probably felt the after effects of those battles. She went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." Now, of course, we know that this is talking about Jacob and Esau, right? She doesn't know that at the time. But this idea of two nations in your womb, this brings up the primary question of prophecy, right? And we're not going to spend too much time on this, but it does need to be addressed. Did the struggle between Edom and Israel happen because God prophesied it? Or did God prophesy it because he knew it would happen? It's a deep question, I know. And it has to do with causality, right? Is the prophecy of God causal or not? That is to say, does God cause these things to happen? Or does he simply know that they will happen and hence the prophecy? Because that's what this is. This is a prophecy, right? Two nations that are going to be at conflict with one another. Now, to be fair, before you wrap your head around that and try to figure out the answer, you can't really know because we're not eternal. And we view time in a linear sort of one thing after the other. It would be totally different to perceive time all at once, as I believe God does. But it is interesting, you think about the conflict that's going to arise between Edom and Israel that really is centuries long conflict. A lot of death, a lot of fighting, a lot of chaos. And why did that happen? Well, as I said, most rivalries begin with a small thing that then snowballs out of control. Genesis 25, 29 through 34. "And once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, 'Let me eat some of that stew, for I am exhausted.' Therefore, his name was called Edom. Jacob said, 'Sell me your birthright now,' selfish guy. Esau said, 'I am about to die. What use is my birthright to me?' Short-sighted guy. Jacob said, 'Swear to me now.' So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright." Now, it would be interesting. I don't know. We don't know. We'll never know. It would be interesting to know if Rebekah ever told her children what had been prophesied before their birth. My suspicion is no, but I don't really know that for a fact. And the thing that happens here, I have to believe, this is their own choices. They don't know the long view that Edom and Israel are going to fight for generations and generations. One guy's hungry, one guy's selfish. That's the end of it. And yet, this is the event, I think, that starts the conflict between Edom, the descendants of Esau, and Israel, the descendants of Jacob. Because for generations from this point forward, I think Edom and those people view Israel as the usurpers, the ones who took what should have been theirs, because Esau should have had the good, the land, the good promises, the good possessions, that all that stuff that would go with his birthrights. Israel ended up in a good, fertile land, a lot of good farming, good shepherding pastures, and Edom ended up in the mountainous, rocky terrain. That's the picture that's been on these slides. That's what Edom would look like. Now, Edom doesn't exist anymore, but that's the kind of terrain they would have been in. Hard terrain to live in, easy to defend, kind of made them into mountain warriors, really, but not easy to live in, not easy to find food and subsistence. There was always a jealousy and resentment. We see this throughout the Old Testament, the jealousy and resentment between Edom and Israel, two nations that never got along. And it's probable that the Edomites always look back to that Genesis 25 story. We should have had that land and that goodness and that blessing of God. Because Esau and his descendants, did they not also come from Abraham? Should they not have had the promises of Yahweh? This brings us, of course, to the book of Obadiah. A lot of lead up to Obadiah, which I got to expand it somehow because it's only one chapter. Obadiah, short book, and it's different than most of the Old Testament. Actually, now that I think about it, it's really different than most of the entire Bible in one very interesting respect. The intended audience is not the children of Israel. And if we look at this in the greater view of Scripture, this is one of the very few books in the Old Testament or New that the audience is not the people of God, quote unquote. The intended audience is not those who are within a covenant relationship with Yahweh. The intended audience is someone outside of this covenant relationship, somebody outside this greater plan of God's relationship with people. This book was written sometime between Babylon's conquest of Israel and then Babylon's eventual conquest of Edom. It's a period of time in there. It's a book about God's judgment on Edom, and as such, it's much more for the Edomites. Obadiah is writing to the Edomites, the descendants of Esau. When he says, you and you and you, he's not talking to Israel, he's talking to the people of this other nation. From it, I think the primary lessons we learn from the book of Obadiah center around this concept of rivalry and how we deal with, most of all, our enemies. So number one, the reason for Edom's punishment. Because Obadiah is a book about God's wrath. As a lot of the prophets are this way, a lot of the major and minor prophets are writing about God's wrath. So why did Obadiah write about Edom's punishment? What did they do to deserve such ire? Obadiah 10 through 14. Because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you. And you shall be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, this is the conquest by Babylon, you were like one of them, like one of Babylon. But do not gloat over the day of your brother and the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah and the day of their ruin. Do not boast in the day of distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity. Do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. Do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of distress. Now, it's interesting the way that Obadiah is orienting this book as if he's talking to people that would do these things in the future, yet these are the things they've already done. His command, these commands, sort of in some way, are too late. Because these are the things that they, in fact, did when Babylon came in to conquer Jerusalem. On the day that you stood aloof. I'm not going to get involved in that. I see a horrible tragedy going on. Not my business. I'm just going to stay over here, do my own thing. That's the attitude of Edom. Not even that. If that was it, I don't think Obadiah would have written his book if that had been their only sin. Not only did they stay aloof, but they did this. to cut off the fugitives at the crossroads. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of distress, as you do when there's a conquering army coming to invade and conquer. People scattered. They fled Jerusalem. And what did Edom do from their mountainous terrain as they watched Jerusalem fall? They went to the roads and they captured the fugitives and took them back to Babylon. And it's almost like they were just waiting for this to happen, right? As Babylon comes in and conquers Jerusalem, people are fleeing to the countryside, probably fleeing to the mountains of Edom. And so they round them up and send them over to Babylon. Here are the people that you missed in your conquest. Do not gloat and do not rejoice. The attitude that Obadiah presents as Edom's attitude is one of gladness for the suffering of Israel. And this is, of course, gladness that was born out of centuries of rivalry, centuries of conflict. And this is the temptation that we have, right? People that we struggle with for a long period of time, we just can't wait for them to get their comeuppance. As Edom had been waiting for this day for centuries. So they were glad. They were rejoicing. The transgression broadly falls into three categories: idleness, participation, and pride. Edom was slow to help, eager to persecute, and proud of Israel's destructions. These are three deadly attitudes that we might have toward our own rivals. The ways that we might think about those who mistreat us. So God's punishment then, the wrath that would befall them, what would happen to Edom? And so this is a picture of what Edom probably looked like. Obadiah 1 through 4. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations. Rise up, let us rise against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You shall be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who dwell in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Because their terrain was very defensible. Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. The theme of Edom's consequence, and indeed the theme of Obadiah as a whole, is the theme of poetic justice. Of taking that which was done to one and doing it to the other. Taking that which they did and doing it to them. 5-7. If thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, how you would have been destroyed. Would they not steal only enough for themselves? If gape-gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. All your allies have driven you to your border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. They have prevailed against you. Those who eat your bread have set up a trap beneath you. You have no understanding. As they stole from others, they would be stolen from. Because here's the other thing that Edom did. Babylon comes in, conquers Jerusalem, carries people all the way back, and then Jerusalem's just sitting there. They have wealth upon wealth, mostly accumulated in the realm and the rule of Solomon. So they go in and they plunder Israel, because it's right there for the taking, right? And notice that they stole, their theft was extreme. He says, most thieves would take and leave some for the people who live there. Like, you're not going to take everything, you're going to leave them something to survive on. But no, Edom went so far as to steal even that which they needed to survive. Their theft was even more significant than most thieves. 8-9. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of Mount Esau? And your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman, so that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter. And ultimately, this is what happened. Like their cousins in Israel, Edom was captured and conquered by Babylon. As they stood and watched and participated in the destruction of Israel at the hands of the Babylonians, so the nations around them watched and participated as Babylon came and destroyed them. Poetic justice, that's the theme of the book. 15-18. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deed shall return on your own head. As you have drunk on my holy mountain, that being Jerusalem, so all the nations shall drink continually. They shall drink and swallow and shall be as though they had never been. But in Mount Zion, there shall be those who escape. And it shall be holy, and the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau stubble. They shall burn them and consume them, and there shall be no survivor for the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. What should we learn from this? Edom, who mistreated Israel, who, in all fairness, we can understand their angst toward Israel, can't we? I can understand it. Edom, coming from the firstborn of Isaac, man, took a little while there. Coming from the firstborn of Isaac, should have had the blessing, should have had the promises, should have had the good land, who were not deceived, but taken advantage of by Jacob the usurper. And then later on, as Jacob and Esau continued to be in conflict, Jacob seemed to get the upper hand every time. And so I understand this sort of national angst that would have existed. And yet, generations have gone by. Could they not have worked it out over centuries? Could they not have turned and repented and done what was right? What are we to learn from this? Number one, the first thing we learn, I think, attitudes that God hates. It's particularly our attitudes towards our enemies, right? Because that's what we're learning about, is those that we are in conflict with. Attitudes that God hates that we have toward our enemies. God hates when we rejoice over the suffering of others. He hates that. Because who knows when you will be the one suffering? Do not rejoice at the suffering of others as Edom rejoiced over Israel. Even though it's very tempting to be glad when our enemies get theirs, quote unquote, right? Because don't we wait for that? These people that we're in conflict with, we want them to be punished. We want them to get what's coming to them. And even if that should happen, our attitude should not be gladness. Our attitude should still be sorrow over the suffering and misfortune of those, even those who are enemies. Do not rejoice over the suffering of others. Do not stand by idle at the suffering of others. God hates it when we see those in need and we just stand by and watch. That was what Edom did, right? Edom, as they saw the refugees fleeing, they refused to help. And in fact, they went so far as to pile on. But when we see those in distress, even those who are enemies, even those who have been in conflict with us, even those who have mistreated us, do not stand by idle at their misfortune. Help them as Christ did for you while you were an enemy. Isn't that what Romans 5 says? For at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For while we were still sinners, Christ died. It's easy to fall into the trap of, they didn't help me, so why should I, right? That's the attitude we have. Well, they mistreated me, so I'm just going to let them suffer. They didn't help me when I was in need, so I'm not going to help them. What's the problem with that? What if everybody had that attitude? Are you not eventually going to be in some sort of trouble? Wouldn't you like it for people to help you when you're in trouble, whatever that may be? And what is it the golden rule says? Treat others the way that you would want to be treated. So if we want people to help us when we're in distress, we want people to get over their hatred of us, even if we've mistreated them, should we be standing by idle at the suffering of others? Of course, most of all, I think God hates when we contribute to the suffering of others. When we not only stand idle, not only feel glad, but we actively pursue the suffering of others. As Edom captured the refugees, rounded them up and sent them back to Babylon. They could have just let them go, and that would have been one thing, right? They could have just watched and been glad and not participated in the slaughter of Israel, even though, of course, it would be so, so satisfying sometimes, wouldn't it, to just kick people a little bit when they're down, especially those who have mistreated us, those who have been our rivals. Number two, God has a habit of executing poetic justice. It's not just in the book of Obadiah, but God really does have this attitude of what you do and how you treat others will eventually come back to you. Matthew 6, 14 and 15, for if you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. Matthew 7, 1 through 3, judge not that you not be judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck in your own eye or in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that's in your eye? These verses scare me. They should scare you. Because as I consider the way that I evaluate other people, especially those I know have mistreated me, it's difficult to forgive, isn't it? And yet, if I'm to read these verses correctly, should I not be worried that my refusal to forgive might lead God to refuse to forgive me? The idea of poetic justice, that how you treat others, it will be treated to you, should be sobering and frightening. Carefully consider how you treat others, knowing that it will influence how God treats you. 3, the suffering of God's people is only temporary. We're going to, I think, this is the last point of the lesson. Obadiah 19 through 21. Those of the Negev shall possess Mount Esau. Those of the Shephelah shall possess the land of the Philistines. They shall possess the land of Ephraim and the land of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead. The exiles of this host of the people of Israel shall possess the land of the Canaanites as far as Zarephath. And the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad shall possess the cities of the Negev. Saviors shall go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. We know, of course, because we have the whole picture, that Israel's suffering was only temporary. They were conquered for a time, and then they went home. 70 years in captivity. Edom did not have such a gracious restoration. God's people may suffer for a time, but that suffering is only temporary. The suffering of the enemies of God, even though it may not happen in this life, we know will be eternal. Which is why we should not look idly by at the suffering of our enemies. What greater chance will we have to turn enemies into friends than helping them when they're down? What greater opportunity would we possess to convince somebody of the truth of the gospel than to help people at their time of need, especially when they have mistreated us in the past? That is the greatest opportunity we have to snatch people out of the eternal fire and allow their suffering to be merely temporary. Because we know for those who are God's, our suffering will not last. Israel was disciplined for a time, but eventually restored, and God wants to restore you to a right eternal state and to not keep you in eternal consequence. The lessons we can learn from the book of Obadiah is how we treat our enemies, to treat them with forgiveness and mercy, to seek out opportunities to help them in times of strife, and to let things go from the past, because that's how A, we stay in God's good graces ourselves, and 2, how we might reach them with the gospel.